From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. In the second hour of the show, I'm very pleased to be joined by my next guest, who has been a consistent voice raising questions, criticizing, throwing up alternative ways to do things. And Dr. Claire Craig has been a pathologist since 2001, who's been working in the NHS and reaching consultant level in 2009. Claire specialised in cancer diagnostics, including testing for cancer within mass screening programs. And as well as doing all of that, she subsequently worked on artificial intelligence for cancer diagnostics. And is one of the key members of HEART, the Health Advisory and Recovery Team. Claire, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Alan.
So I suppose... So many things are going on at the moment, right? There's this in the broader world discussion about banks and the economic system. There's war going on. And in the midst of all of this, one of the most, the biggest, most important things to have happened to the world all at the same time simultaneously is almost as though people have kind of wanted to forget it a bit, yet talk about it when it suits them. And I suppose what I'd like to do with you a little bit is just touch on, I mean, we just touch on some of the things that we're seeing now. So, for instance, even though we're being told the COVID inquiry, which we can talk about, is saying it's going to be about 7 years and it's going to cost more than any other inquiry. And you can just see what this is going to mean down the road in terms of people's interest and what that's really going to mean. But we've also seen that the Telegraph has run a series of things with the Twitter, with the lockdown files and messaging and things like that. Just tell us from your point of view, in terms of where we are now, how much do you think we've learned and taken on board from what's just happened in the last 3 years?
Well, that depends entirely on who you mean by we, doesn't it?
Yes.
So I think there are some of us who I think have a really good handle on what happened. I think nobody understands all of the why around what happened. And I think there's still, there's this sort of interesting middle group of people who are the majority probably, who sort of developed some sort of subconscious understanding that things were not quite what they were told, and that, you know, that the fear was a bit overblown, and just vaguely understanding aspects of it, but without really being able to articulate what the issues are. And I think, you know, we really need to reach that group and explain it to them, because the issues are really important and the way it was manipulated was really important. And I think we are getting to a stage now where people are in a calm enough mindset to listen and understand it, which is important. But you're right, there is also this desire to just put it all behind us, which I totally understand, because it's been horrendous.
So, I mean, there's so many areas, and obviously at HEART, you've got people that have been looking at all of them. I mean, on the one hand, Dr. Ros Jones, I mean, you've had discussions, and like we at Together have challenged vaccinating children, saying we don't, you know, they're not needed. But you've got people like Dr. Gary Sidley, who's kind of in your work, you've all been challenging masks for kids in schools. And then Carol Sikora, who warned about the impacts of cancer, and we know that also stroke and heart disease, if you just make it a COVID-only NHS, Tony Hinton and others. Lots of people who are very good in their areas and respected in their fields. Just tell us a little bit what it's been like in terms of some of the smearing and the attacks, and what's that meant for you, and how much do you think, looking back on that now, those people that you just mentioned, the people that are in the middle that were kind of maybe not sure what's just happened and everything, how that can be reconciled with them, and in terms of a public discussion about both science and policy and what that means?
First of all, to say Carol Sikora is a brilliant man, but he's not actually in HEART. But the other people you mentioned are. And the attacks that HEART had was really a summer 2021 thing, where our private messages were leaked at a time when saying things like masks don't work was enough to discredit people. And so, you know, articles were written about this group of doctors who think lockdowns and masks don't work, as if that was discreditable. And it's kind of, I have found it fascinating as someone who's not, you know, I'm not a psychologist, learned a lot about psychology in the last few years. But the fact that people hear something that they think means someone's been discredited, and from then on, that they're sort of, that tag is in their brain, you know, right? Well, yeah, but they're discredited, so I can't trust them. And it's, you know, the people who are doing the discrediting know full well that that's how it works. So it doesn't actually matter whether or not the content of what was said was true. What mattered was the atmosphere it was said in and how it was interpreted, which is really problematic when you think about it. And when that happened for us in Hart, it had huge implications for particular individuals who were brought up in front of their employers or had professional regulators start breathing down their necks. And, you know, it caused a huge amount of upset. And nevertheless, we, you know, stuck through it together and carried on doing what we do. And what we do is just to discuss internally what's going on, share stuff, educate each other, and then write about it in a way that lay people can understand. And just, you know, continue trying to explain the real science and what was really going on for a lay audience. And, you know, we've continued to do that and we've grown our audience doing it. But we still have people who think they can say, well, they're discredited and ignore us. And the real harm that was done is that we were trying to engage with journalists who could, you know, actually make a difference, or politicians who could actually make a difference, who got scared off because of slurs that were, as I say, you know, utterly ridiculous slurs. But nevertheless, that meant that they were scared to support us and scared to reinforce our messaging. And that's where the real harm was done, because it's just been a much, much slower journey to get the message through to people, and it needn't have been.
I mean, it does. If we think about this, I've just had Francis on, and we were talking about some of the measures in terms of our liberty and policing and the state and law and people, you know, the role of the citizen. I think in this area, I'm talking to you about trust and the discussion around science and the public and people that are in positions there. I mean, it's very difficult to retain trust when we've seen so many things like the psychological fear that's been purposely created. And also just what the whole question of what the public discussion about science is it all contrived? Is it all about PR for either political purposes or for big, you know, financial interests? Or is it the case that you can still make a robust defense of the pursuit of science in the same way that some of those people who were also smeared and worse, who were tortured, you know, obviously, like historically, from the Galileos to the Copernicuses and many others who also had many accusations thrown at them, but in the pursuit of science and objective truth continued. But do you think that the kind of this whole we're following the science thing has diminished and cheapened and reduced the sense of what science is? How do you see it?
I totally do. And I think it felt like really that was a sort of pinnacle of what had been happening in regards to science over time. So I think, you know, the sort of faith that non-scientists put in science has been getting disproportionately high prior to this ridiculous explosion in putting your faith in the science. And it just shows a total misunderstanding of what science is. So what science is a way of getting closer to understanding the world. So all we ever can do is sort of have a model that sort of explains things and then try to improve that model and correct that model and replace it with a new one. And so what you're doing in science really is you're always looking for where we're wrong and trying to figure out how we can come closer to what reality is by changing how we think about things. But it doesn't, it's the way it's been presented is that science has the answer to everything. Now, science has got, you know, by using that method, we have managed to answer a lot of questions, and that's great. But it's a process, you know, we're always discovering and we're always trying to improve on what we know. So the idea that there is some body of scientific knowledge, which is the truth, is just not the case. You know, that's really not the case. And it's incredibly harmful for science to consider it to be a fixed body of knowledge. And it's also really harmful for, as you call it, the public trust in science, because what we need the public to trust is that we have a process, and the process involves correction and error. And that process is worth trusting, because that's all it is error correction. Of course, we should trust error correction. And it's a bit like saying that some politicians hold the truth. Now, of course, they don't hold the truth, and that's why you have opposition and debate. And it's the same for science. So, you know, we can do is strive towards what's true, but doing so through correction and debate and that method. And the thing, there was a time when I was a bit distressed about this loss of trust. But over time, and especially the loss of trust in the medical profession, that seemed really damaging, especially, you know, when you've got patients who sometimes are at a very vulnerable point in their life with a new diagnosis. And I felt like they needed to be able to put their trust entirely in the medical profession as a means of supporting them. But over time, I have sort of come to terms with the fact that trust has been damaged, and that that's not all bad, and that holding, you know, you shouldn't outsource all of your trust to anything. You know, you're responsible for your own health, and you're responsible for your own decisions and your own thoughts. And yes, you can't, we all outsource some of our thinking, because we can't do everything from first principles. And we all outsource some of our looking after our health, because, you know, we need the support of professionals to do that. But ultimately, you're responsible. And so having slightly diminished trust might be a good thing in the long run. And having this sort of moment in time where science has been misinterpreted in this horrible way has the potential for becoming a beginning of a new era where people are allowed to be much more open-minded, and we might have a sort of new renaissance in science and treat it much more like the Victorians did, where if you sort of read about particular Victorians, they often, some of them held beliefs that we think are extraordinary alongside ones that we revere. So for instance, Marie Curie, you know, we all know about her and her amazing work with radiation. And she sort of held up as this brilliant female scientist, but she would go to seances and believe in that sort of aspect of things that, you know, we know that lots of us don't believe in anymore. And that was fine. That was fine in those days. You were allowed to believe in strange things, beliefs about magnetism and hypnosis and all sorts of things that over time, you know, might be proved wrong. And that was fine, because you could accept that, well, nobody in any era through history has been right about everything. And to think that we are the first generation that will be is utterly embarrassing. Of course, we're not going to be right about everything. And people in the future will look back and laugh at us. And we won't know today what those things they'll laugh at us for will be. But all we can do is explore things and try and be open-minded.
Well, that's really important. Just on that, the attempt to understand the world and shape it and use the scientific method and approach of investigation and testing and appliance. I want to look at a number of things. Obviously, the Florida Surgeon General has said some things. We've had a big discussion. Andrew Bridgen has said some things in Parliament. But just more before we get into all of that, just in terms, surely there should be a universal relationship to science and the method, which says that it should not ever be politicized, that it always should be about inquiry and the pursuit, objective truth. And what we've seen is it was hijacked. The term and everything was hijacked with a very particular instrumentalization by the government and by others, and I think by Sage and others, that just kept doing a kind of very PR marketing oriented position. We follow the science. This is the science. You know, there's no questions. There's no criticism. There's no doubt. Oh, the antithesis of science, actually, based on what you've just described. Would that be a good sound claim to say, actually, the pursuit of science should be free, should be at the just the only thing it should adhere to is knowledge, regardless of where it leads us, and should never be politicized?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I've agree with you entirely. I've got a book coming out soon, and I have a chapter about how politics is the antithesis of science, because it really is. As a politician, you need to have a story that, you know, is probably a bit oversimplified, and that is compelling, and that you will stand by regardless. And that really is the opposite of what science is. And so the trouble is that science and medicine and politics do have this area of overlap in public health, because, you know, that's where medicine meets politics. And it's a really ugly thing, that, as we've seen in the last few years. And the public health, I mean, it's really hard to tell, isn't it, who was really making the difference, who was really influencing, who was really in power. And the WhatsApp messages have sort of shed a slightly different light on that in some regards. And obviously, ultimately, of course, it's the politicians who are responsible. But when public health officials give them difficult ultimatums and sort of say, well, if you don't do this, people will be dying in hospital car parks, that doesn't give them a lot of choice about decisions that are being made.
No, I want to come back to that as well, particularly the public health issue and politics and what can be done. I'm really excited to hear about your book. I definitely want to know more about that. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Claire Craig. This is TNT Radio. We'll be back just after this.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
Australia has taken a decision in the military sphere which Australians may struggle to comprehend the significance of the step change that this decision involves. I thought I should go back just a few years to 2014. The Abbott government will select a Japanese-built Soroya-class submarine. So that's 2014. Then on April 26, 2016, French company DCNS will build Australia's $50 billion new Barracuda submarine fleet in Adelaide. So then we have round three of this extraordinary, magnificent step change in submarines, which came on the 16th of September 2021, when we learned that it was not the Japanese, not the French, but Australia is embarking on its most significant change of defence and strategic direction in decades. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said a new alliance had been formed with the UK and the US that was the most significant security development for Australia since the ANZUS Treaty. Interesting that ScoMo flipped on a dime from the commitment which we forced the French to comply with, that the submarines must not be nuclear powered.
Ross Cameron on TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Climate change policies will only widen the gap between the rich and the poor. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller, and we were just in the thick of it with Dr. Claire Craig. Claire, you were talking about the intersection of public policy and politics and what that means. I mean, just to say, forget COVID for a second, if we can. If you go back a bit, my experience in being in the nighttime economy sector is that the public health lobby is what I will call it, the public health agenda, had a huge impact, very damaging impact on British cities up and down the country, with its consistent belligerent parts of it, belligerent approach towards the idea that any kind of alcohol, there's a kind of new temperance movement, any kind of alcohol represented antisocial behaviour, that all citizens were vectors of crime, violence, predatory behaviour. And actually the solution was to shut down lots of late night licence premises. So that I watched that public health agenda be used and weaponized. And it was, you know, I think in some ways what happened during COVID was it was that on steroids, this kind of very controlling, technocratic approach towards citizens that had been kind of developing a number of ways. In a similar way, perhaps, to how Mayor Bloomberg decided they would ban smoking in parks, which no one would ever be able to prove anywhere that outside smoking can have a harm to someone else. It's purely because they thought they just didn't want people to do it. So these things have been coming down the pipeline for a while, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they have. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because if you're given a little bit of power, there are people who will always sort of abuse that power. And that's almost, I see that almost as the role of government, is to make sure they're not empowering little dictators. And that went terribly wrong with COVID as well. But with this, you've got people, you know, the government empower public health doctors with just, you know, there's your power, but it's in the domain of, you have to keep people safe. And what we know through history is that when you're told keep people safe, you can invent, you know, any number of rules, but they will always be authoritarian rules, because if you're safe, you're not free. Those are also opposites. And you know, if they're given the remit of reducing or keeping people safe, reducing harm, then they're then free. They're then able to implement all sorts of rules that really are completely over the top, and they might well reduce harm. But is that the society we want? I mean, we do have some people who might be, you know, end up in fights after a boozy night. But is that a problem as a wider society? Is it escalating? Is it huge? No, it's something we've always had, and we accept as part of, you know, life. And we wouldn't want to ruin everyone else's happiness in order to reduce that to zero. I do come from that sort of
attitude. I suppose what I want to look at now, Claire, is with you, is to just see, because there's been all sorts of things, like we talked about the lockdown files and some of those things in the WhatsApp, the messages, and the kind of very clear approach that has been kind of dismissive and contemptuous of the public, and just like, this is what we're doing regardless, and just crack on. Now it looks like, well, the argument that was presented was, we had lockdowns, and then the reason why we stopped having lockdowns was because the vaccine program was going to be so effective, and that's what got us out of everything. Just tell me what you think about that, first of all, if you would.
Yeah, so when we had the first wave of COVID, to be honest, at the time I was scared, and was, you know, I wasn't scared for myself after a while, but I remained scared for the NHS and for old people and vulnerable people throughout that wave, and then learnt later on about the mathematics of it. And the mathematics of it show that quite clearly the virus was spreading through a susceptible population, which was not the whole population, it was a fraction of the population. And once it had reached all of those susceptible people, it died away. So once you understand that was what happened with the first peak, then you realize that it wasn't lockdown that brought it down. And that's why we've seen all these studies showing that actually lockdown wasn't the, you know, didn't correlate with when the cases fell. And even within the UK, you can see that there were more remote parts of the UK where their waves began, peaked and ended all after lockdown because they got it last. So once you get that, then you can look at the second wave in a different light. And the different light is to say, well, it was actually, you know, it peaked when respiratory virus infections peak every year. So what caused it to peak was that it had, you know, gone through another proportion of the population who were susceptible to that variant, peaked and fell. And the timing of the vaccines was fairly coincidental to that. And I remember at the time in Heart, when, you know, we'd seen the evidence in the trials and hadn't really got any other evidence to go on, and we all assumed the vaccines were going to work and work well, we were really cross that it was going to be spun as being the first, you know, we've beat the first wave with lockdowns and we've beaten the second one with vaccines, and aren't we wonderful? And, you know, obviously that is how they tried to spin it. And then subsequently we've seen wave after wave. Actually, in the UK, we're a bit of an outlier for subsequent waves. But if you look at Europe or if you look at the USA, you can see that the Delta wave in terms of hospitalizations and deaths was really exactly the same magnitude as the two that went before it. So, you know, you then have a massively vaccinated population and you still get the similar wave of hospitalizations and deaths. So I think that the way it was, it was a huge political project, and as with all huge political projects, it comes with a whole load of spin, which has been really harmful.
So today, yesterday, the Florida Surgeon General said that at this point, he's not sure that if anyone should be taking the jabs for COVID, and that after a period of time, they could make you more susceptible to catching COVID, and he cited The Lancet. We saw Andrew Bridgen, who has, regardless of anything else he's done or said or not, has been taken down from YouTube because of a speech he made in Parliament yesterday, saying that he believes that vaccinations for COVID should now be stopped, with the MHRA, and everyone should stop them because of the risk versus the reward of them, in terms of the risk of that COVID poses to people now in the situation versus the reward of taking the cab versus the risk of harm that might come about from some people in certain groups from taking this procedure. I mean, where do you sit on this? What's your view on it all?
I think they should have been stopped long ago. I think it feels absolutely mad to me that we're still saying it's time to stop when we've been saying that for so, so long. And the data that Andrew Bridgen presented in Parliament was all government data. It was a government calculation of how many people would need to be vaccinated to prevent an intensive care admission. They also did the same sum for general hospital admissions. And the number that you need to vaccinate, and this was assuming that the protection that there was in July 2022 would last for a whole year, which is quite a generous assumption. But making that assumption, they reckoned you'd need to vaccinate tens of thousands of people in order to prevent one intensive care admission. And when you get, you know, obviously it's very, very age dependent. It would be millions for children. And for the oldest group, it was, I think it was more like 2,000. It's age dependent. But when you look at the measurement of how much harm the vaccines cause, and that measurement was based purely on data from the clinical trials of serious adverse events, which means side effects that put people into hospital or gave them life-altering new diagnoses or serious diagnoses that would still be a big deal. When you look at that, then the rate of those was ending up being equivalent to, for older people, or higher than, the chance of actually preventing any harm. So the trouble is that there's been this ridiculous and really clear-cut difference in the approach to looking at vaccine harm compared to looking at COVID harm. And it's really stark when you look at it that way. So if you had COVID, any symptom that you had subsequently was blamed on COVID. I mean, any and every symptom. You look at some of these long COVID papers and literally you can't think of a part of the body or a symptom that hasn't been included in the list that cause of long COVID. Whereas if you were vaccinated, the rule was that nothing was relevant afterwards. Everything was coincidental afterwards. And obviously neither of those are true. You know, it's grey for both of them. But the approach to it was completely divergent. And there is just this denial of harm, which is extraordinary. And the way the MPs left the Parliament chamber when Andrew Bridgen got to his feet was also extraordinary. You know, it's just a refusal to listen. And actually the video that he put up on his YouTube channel included his whole speech, but it also included a very lengthy reply from the minister afterwards. So, you know, he put on his YouTube channel both sides of the debate so that people could listen to both sides and make up their own minds. And then YouTube took that video down. So they really were censoring democracy because they, you know, they've also removed the reply to that from the public domain. I think we have huge problems with this.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, right? I mean, because it's not like anyone's trying to put, well, I don't know if they are trying to pretend, but there's already a compensation scheme for people who have had side effects. Now there's complaints that many of the claims have been rejected and they're not being met, even the ones that have been granted. But I suppose the thing for me as well is because I don't understand much of what's gone on. I understand things from a point of view of our freedoms and liberties. And I obviously understand that if there's a serious threat that we need to do something about it. Although I also understand that if something like Ebola that kills people straight away means it's unlikely to spread that far to everyone. So there's all these things that go on. But the thing is, there's a recognition now that there's a compensation scheme, that some people are harmed. Surely everyone would want to have the conversation. What's the level of risk and what's the level of reward? Very calmly, how many, to avoid any sensationalism and drama, and say, how much of a risk is this to anyone? How much of a benefit? And that's a bit like what many of us argued about what should have happened in terms of any decisions that were made in policy. How much cost is there involved in this and what's the benefit? Why do you think it is there's a flat right out? It might be a silly question, Claire, but bear with me. Well, there's an outright refusal, it seems, from MPs telling people to leave Parliament, to people still being pulled down from social media, to not addressing it properly and fully, to name calling and smearing. Why is there a flat out refusal to just discuss this rationally and calmly in public?
Well, I'm going to give a slightly unusual answer to that question, which is that the word vaccine is an incredibly powerful word. You know, we as children are taught to trust them. And we as adults are taught to despise anti-vaxxers as dangerous, right? So it has this sort of, it's treated differently to any other drug. It's treated as something that if you question it or criticize it, you could be dangerous and you could be, you know, harming other people because they might not then take it. And obviously that implies that it can only do good. And I think we've ended up with a situation where it was presented. Well, first of all, the drugs that they've presented were not obviously going to ever be classifiable as vaccines. And I think the drug companies really must have popped open the champagne when they managed to get that label attached to them, because they don't fit the old definition of what that meant. And it meant that they didn't have to go through all the usual regulatory hoops for a drug. They could skip them because they are now vaccines. So the situation we've got is a society where people were scared, and scared people are looking for reassurance. And then the vaccines were presented as a savior. And they have been treated ever since as a saviour, to the extent that anybody that criticises them are treated as blasphemers. And I know that's an extraordinary thing to say, but when you look at it through that lens, it does, things start to make a lot more sense. That, you know, the way people are not allowed to criticize them in any way, and that most people refuse to even listen to it as if it might sort of harm their sacred thinking if they hear these blasphemous comments. But that's, I think, where we're at. It really was a sort of cult of vaccines. And when you think about how people performed dances and music, and, you know, that there was, we had religious leaders urging everybody to come and take them. I mean, it was a really, really extraordinary thing when you can look at it from a distance. I just wanted to touch on one of the things you raised before about what the Florida Surgeon General said, which is that, you know, we do have evidence now that further doses are actually really doing very odd things to the immune system. So if you think about your immune system, its job really is to detect things as foreign. That's what it does. And it doesn't have a tick box list of I've seen this, I've seen that. It detects foreign shapes. So if it sees a shape of something that's different to what you look like, then it'll attack it, which means it can learn from other infections about new ones, even if it's a novel infection it hasn't had before. And what your immune system also has to do is ignore things it sees all the time that are foreign. So you want it to ignore pollen that you breathe in, and you want to ignore any food that you're eating. So there's a system within your immune system that sort of switches things off and says, oh, don't worry about that, you can ignore that. And those are particular antibodies called IgG4 antibodies. And what we're finding is that people who've been repeatedly jabbed with this same Wuhan spike again and again and again are now developing these IgG4 antibodies to it. So their immune system is starting to say, oh, we can ignore that, which is hugely dangerous. And really, we need to be talking about that much, much more, because, you know, people have had multiple vaccines and they're still being sold as if they are needed, and when actually they are now doing more than nothing. They're actually potentially doing the opposite of what they're meant to be doing.
So we've had the Cochrane report, which now finally, I mean, most people who are serious have gone quiet about masks, although I am seeing quite a few people wearing them again. And it was weird that with masks, you saw some of the most virulent accusations, really divisive in many ways. But we've seen the Cochrane report. We know that we know that children are at very low risk, and yet in America, babies and people up to six months old onwards are being offered and told to take the jab. I mean, in New York, these leaflets are coming through the doors for people. It does sort of beg a belief a little bit, does it not, that you know, that this is still happening?
Absolutely. And there've been for years, I've thought, wow, this can't get any worse. And I'm constantly being surprised. And I think we're quite lucky in the UK that I think it's a combination of, you know, some amazing campaigns like the Safer to Wait campaign, which did a really good job of educating parents around children and vaccines. But we never had in the UK the same government pressure, for example, with masking primary school children. You know, that was never a thing. I think culturally, somehow, we're more protective of our children anyway. And we never had the same propaganda that the US had inflicted on them around children and COVID. So they had all sorts of rubbish talked about children and COVID that just wasn't true, and that they've only slowly backtracked on. But in the meantime, parents were genuinely scared that their children were at high risk, healthy children were at high risk of dying of COVID. And that's why they then lined them up for vaccines. And that's why they're still scared of their own children and putting them in masks. And you know, the fact that they've got masked up children when actually mostly the rest of society is kind of carrying on as normal is just really, really backwards. You know, adults have a role to protect children. It's not the other way around.
Indeed. And then, so tell us, I mean, obviously you've got a book coming out, but just now in this period as we go along, what is it that you guys are doing at Heart? What's the approach? And what can we learn from this last period? And what can be done differently? And how do you think, from the point of view of anyone who's campaigning or who's been concerned about what's going on, I would have to say, right, just to say that it's, I mean, my point of view with Together and all the people that we work with, it's been remarkable that I've met so many brilliant people, and there's some, been some great protests and hundreds of thousands of people coming out. And but many people we did not get to. I know that we didn't, you know, there was much censorship and all of that. And that's always been one of my concerns, that we haven't managed to get out to enough people. I always want to get more, particularly in this kind of age of when in doubt, restrict and legislate and impose, which is obviously how we're carrying on campaigning it together. But what is your area? What are you working on now? And can you give us any insights into any of that?
Okay, so let me talk about the book briefly first. So probably about 18 months ago, I thought I'm going to have to start writing this down as a book, because I'd realized the issue we had was that there'd been so many lies told and there was so much confusion that actually trying to get through to somebody was quite complicated, because you might explain one part of it to them, but then they'd be like, well, what about the rest? It doesn't make sense unless you really can see the whole picture. And so I thought, well, the only way you can do that is with, when you've got someone's undivided attention for, you know, a fair amount of time. And the way to do that is with a book. And I'm not a natural writer, and it's taken a while. And it's taken a while even having finished to get it out, which has been really frustrating. But I'm very nearly there now. And it's called Expired: COVID, the Untold Story. And what it is it's based around beliefs that people had about COVID and where those beliefs originated, what they were based on, and which aspects of them were questionable and which aspects of them have been proved wrong. So I kind of take them one at a time and start with where people were at with what all the sort of official story was, and then just, you know, look into it a bit deeper and see which parts of it were wrong, which parts of it were right. And then also talk generally about the psychology of belief and the philosophy of belief and fear and that impact on it, a bit about politics, just to kind of make it into a rounder thing, and a lot about ethics, a lot about ethics and Western values and principles and how we've overridden them. So hopefully that'll be out in the next month. And fantastic. Then one of the other things I've been working on with a group of people from not just Heart, but actually much, much wider than that, is a report which should be out in the next few days, looking at all the ways in which our medical regulator failed us. And it really is myriad ways, from, you know, before any approvals were made, what wasn't done, and since then, all the things that haven't been done and all the things that have been ignored and the way that they've lacked transparency in every aspect of it. We've really sort of gone into that deep detail. So that should also be out next week. And also in Heart, we're continuing to write our weekly bulletins, which you can sign up for on the website, which is heartgroup.org, where we will update you with what's going on and just explain any scientific papers that are important, and you know, writing for a lay audience about the science around the subject, really. So, yeah, those are the main things that I've been up to.
Great. Well, I can't wait to see them read the book, and we'll definitely have to get you back to talk to us about that. And in terms of ongoing, like how things are regulated and what they've done and their kind of due diligence, it just strikes me that that's really essential. And, you know, I don't want to be cynical and just think, because prior to COVID, there was a kind of sense that anything that's big and that just makes money is inherently bad. And I think that partly that was an outlook about, it was a bit of an anti-modern, like kind of slightly dystopian view. It's certainly, though, the case that where lots of money and interest are involved, there's lobbying, and there's we can perhaps see a role that's being played in this current period. I suppose the thing is, Claire, just to your finishing thoughts before we go to the break and we round up, is just from an advocate of someone who's passionate about the scientific method and also about life and society, how would you most like, what if you could say, this is the one way, this is the one thing that we, the takeaway, this is the way that we should approach things in the future in terms of this question about public health, and what would you say that is? What would you be your approach?
So my approach should be to say, as a Western society, you know, where we our foundation is about error correction and debate and listening to other people's voices. We need to have that embedded throughout what we do, which means having counter voices heard at every level. So, you know, we shouldn't have a chief scientific officer that gets to be omniscient on science. We should have that, but we should also have a red team, as they call them, of people critiquing what he says, so that the politicians aren't hearing preaching, they're hearing both sides. And that needs to happen in everything that we do. We need to be making sure that all voices are heard.
Absolutely fantastic. Dr. Claire Craig, thank you for joining me today. We'll be hearing and seeing much more of you, I'm sure, and look forward to getting you back soon. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll be back with you just after this break. We'll
with his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen testified before the Senate Finance Committee today, and she admitted that the Fed's rate hikes played a role in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. She also admitted that Silicon Valley Bank received special treatment and that community banks might not be so lucky. Indeed, she all but said the quiet parts out loud. Hey, Heartland, and all you red state MAGA mutts, we hate you. In case you hadn't figured it out, we will contaminate your air and water. We will shutter your banks and businesses. We will kill off all your livestock. We will poison your fields. And we will smoke you out one way or another. We want you dead. Oh, and she also admitted that Social Security benefits will be 24% lower in 9 years when the federal government's retirement Ponzi scheme finally goes bankrupt. Not to worry, I've known since the 1980s that I and my generation were going to get stiffed on Social Security. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative, this is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Just quoting Klaus Schwab is alarming enough. If he and his billionaire friends achieve their Great Reset, tyranny would be the new world order. Born in Ravensburg, Germany in 1938, Klaus Schwab is a child of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, a political state regime built on fear and violence, on brainwashing and control, on propaganda and lies. While the Nazis desired a new order for Germany that would last 1,000 years, Klaus Schwab's vision extends globally and would potentially be unstoppable were nations to relinquish all sovereignty and adopt the neurotechnologies and biotechnologies which forces us, in the words of Klaus Schwab, to question what it means to be human.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. Two really remarkable guests, Francis Hoare, who's a barrister at Field Court Chambers and quite rightly has had many nominations for awards as a young barrister, and his commitment to free speech and freedom and liberty consistent. And then Dr. Claire Craig and Heart. And if people want to get to Heart, you can go to heartgroup.org. We're looking forward to seeing that report, and together works with Heart, as we do with Us for Them and many other campaign groups, and together is launching a cabinet, a shadow cabinet, with experts in a number of different fields. Like, we have the cabinet in government talking about the economy, industry, housing, transport, democracy, culture, digital media and sport, and a range of other areas, particularly education and children. And we are going to be having people from the cabinet speaking across the board at press, in the media, and at events up and down the country. And in addition to that, linking up with our campaigning work that we've been doing up and down the country. And we just had a fantastic event in Birmingham, and a big shout out to everyone there and in King's Heath who are challenging the LTNs. We've got lots of businesses involved in residents, where we've seen so-called consultations where they are very loaded. They don't listen to the responses when they get them in. They're utterly undemocratic, like we've seen in Hackney, haven't we? And we just saw this week that Mehdi Cobban in Stoke Newington, my neck of the woods, my manor, where I cycle and walk and drive and live and work and do all sorts of things. Mehdi Cobban telling us that 60% of people have said in N16 that they want to continue with the ANPR cameras and the charges on Church Street. Utter nonsense, because what he really means is a few people have responded on the Hackney website and they've taken that from there. So we'll be challenging that in Hackney, as people are challenging in Haringey. In Haringey, we know that Mike Hakata has said to us all, it's going to be painful. We're going to make it as painful as possible. Like Duncan Enright in Oxford, who said, this is going to happen anyway, way before the consultation had finished and way before the council had met, or with the very own London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, who ignores over 5,000 respondents from Fairfield because it is not acceptable to have those sorts of people respond, who has ordered the ANPR cameras before the consultation even started and is using numbers that the actual report said don't ever use these numbers in to legitimize. It's the only way he thinks he can legitimize this 4,000 people dying. It's just not democratic. It's not acceptable. And many are challenging it. And today in Trafalgar Square, people have got together, I hear, and I'm giving a big shout out to them who are challenging you, Les. We know that over 50,000, nearly 70,000 people in Birmingham have challenged and refused to pay the Clean Air Zone charges, their equivalent of ULEZ. So not only are they trying to chop Birmingham into six zones, citing examples like King's Heath and around Lascelles and Handsworth and other areas around that, they also have got this charge to come into the city. We've seen that congestion's built up. It is a question about how to deal with congestion on some of the ring roads in Birmingham. But urban planning takes innovation. It takes proper planning that puts the public at the heart of things. We want to have parks as well as roads. We need to be able to be mobile. When did we ever agree that we were going to give up our mobility? Where was the conversation? Where was the cost-benefit analysis with anyone? Was it laid out in front of us? Not in London and not in Canterbury and not in Bath and not in Cambridge and not in Edinburgh and not in Glasgow. And in Scotland, they're trying to pioneer many of these 15 and 20 minute neighbourhoods. And we've got some news for them there, because we've got people that are challenging up and down the country with Together Hubs, working with other local groups, businesses and residents, where people are saying this is unacceptable, where people have, some of them have never been involved in politics before, a bit like some of the people who are challenging the lockdowns. But these circumstances where businesses are being impacted, harmed and closed down, as well as the damages of lockdowns, and where people are not able to move around. It's taken me three times the amount of time to go and see my disabled mum. These things are having big impacts on people and they're challenging. And there are going to be more challenges, not just in the local areas, but nationwide. So big shout to everyone in each of those areas, to everyone we're working with in Oxford, in Cambridge, in Canterbury, up and down the country. We've got friends that are doing that in Wales and elsewhere. We know that in the northeast, in Sheffield and Leeds, big challenges, and in Warrington, certainly in Birkenhead and the Wirral, as Catherine, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and Dan Davis, a big shout out to him. And congratulations, Dan, on being re-nominated as chair of the Institute of Licensing for another 3 years. You've done sterling work in the Wirral and also in hospitality. At Together, we're going to have some more big news coming out very soon. If you want to find out more about us, go to togetherdeclaration.org. We, as ever, follow our principles that have been forged through the experience of challenging things in lockdown. And they are to insist on upholding free speech, on the rights to be able to protest, on no more impositions and restrictions, that there has to always be a cost-benefit analysis and proper parliamentary scrutiny. The kids don't need these COVID jabs. More and more, it's sounding like nobody does at this point. That we have the public at the heart of things, that when decisions are made, They need to be democratic, and the public has to be front and center, not technocratic impositions, not surveillance and control and limits, but that we decide what we need and things are done on that basis. We've just had a digital ID consultation. We know with all the discussions around Credit Suisse and SVB Bank that the discussion around digital bank central currency is a big one, the digital dollar, and in the UK, the digital pound, and that the idea of a programmable currency should send shivers down people's spines. So get involved with us together. We're at TogetherDeck on Twitter, togetherdeclaration.org. I'm Alan Miller. I look forward to seeing you next week and speaking to you more. This is TNT Radio. Have a good week. Let's uphold our freedoms together.